Good afternoon, everyone. We'll start the Sutta study class now. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. So as I said, we'll be looking at Majjhima Nikaya Sutta 137. That's the Salayatana Vibhanga Sutta, the exposition of the sixfold base. But before we get into the study of that particular sutta, I'd like to start by looking at a sutta from the Samyutta Nikaya, the Connected Discourses series. And this is the teaching that I've been focusing on over the weekend. And it's about the nature of feelings and the role that they play in supporting the mind when it contacts objects. That the tendency to lust after pleasant feelings and to have aversion towards unpleasant feelings, and the ignorance of feelings which are neither pleasant nor unpleasant, is the place where we are really in bondage. And this is where all of the other aspects of the teaching which we're going to look at this afternoon in the Majjhima Nikaya, where that teaching converges, they all converge on feeling, because it is our reaction to feeling which keeps us bound in samsara. The pleasant feeling that we pursue and the unpleasant feeling that we resist. And until we understand this and understand the connection of feeling to all our sensory contacts, then if we are looking to free ourselves from suffering and free ourselves from bondage, we will always be looking outside, externally, at things in the world as a source of our problems, as a source of our suffering, when in fact it is within us. It's the pursuing of pleasant feeling and the trying to get away from the unpleasant feeling, which is the source of suffering and keeps us bound. So in this particular teaching called the Dart in the Vedana Samyutta, which is the chapter on the connected discourses on feeling, this particular sutta is very important because it shows us how it's not just simply chasing after pleasant feeling and the objects that give rise to pleasant feeling, but it's trying to get away from unpleasant feeling, from painful feeling, that it also drives us on to seek pleasure here and there. And that this running on reinforces the underlying tendency within the mind to lust after pleasure and to run away from unpleasant sensations. So that even if we are acting on the external objects, and even if we're acting on the surface of the mind, that there are these underlying tendencies towards lust and aversion which are being fed and we may not be aware of it. So I'll just start with the sutta called the Dart in the Vedana Samyutta, chapter 36 in the Samyutta Nikaya. Because the uninstructed worldling feels a pleasant feeling, a painful feeling, and a neither painful nor pleasant feeling. The instructed noble disciple too feels a pleasant feeling, a painful feeling, and a neither painful nor pleasant feeling. Therein, bhikkhus, what is the distinction, the disparity, and the difference between the instructed noble disciple and the uninstructed worldling? Because when the uninstructed worldling is contacted by a painful feeling, he sorrows, grieves, and laments. He weeps, beating his breast, and becomes distraught. He feels two feelings, a bodily one and a mental one. Suppose they were to strike a man with a dart, and then they would strike him immediately afterwards with a second dart, so that the man would feel a feeling caused by two darts. So too, when the uninstructed worldling is being contacted by a painful feeling, he feels two feelings, a bodily one and a mental feeling. Being contacted by that same painful feeling, he harbours aversion towards it. When he harbours aversion towards painful feeling, the underlying tendency to aversion towards painful feeling lies behind this. Being contacted by painful feeling, he seeks delight in sensual pleasure. For what reason? Because the uninstructed worldling does not know of any escape from painful feeling other than sensual pleasure. When he seeks delight in sensual pleasure, the underlying tendency to lust for pleasant feeling lies behind this. He does not understand, as it really is, the origin and the passing away, the gratification, the danger, and the escape in the case of these feelings. When he does not understand these things, the underlying tendency to ignorance in regard to neither painful nor pleasant feeling lies behind this. If he feels a pleasant feeling, he feels it attached. If he feels a painful feeling, he feels it attached. And if he feels a neither painful nor pleasant feeling, he feels it attached. This, bhikkhus, is called an uninstructed worldling who is attached to birth, aging, and death, who is attached to sorrow, lamentation, pain, displeasure, and despair, who is attached to suffering, I say. Bhikkhus, when the instructed noble disciple is contacted by a painful feeling, he does not sorrow, grieve, or lament. He does not weep, beating his breast and becoming distraught. He feels one feeling, a bodily one, not a mental one. Suppose they were to strike a man with a dart, but they would not strike him immediately afterwards with a second dart. So too, that man would feel a feeling caused by one dart only. So too, when the instructed noble disciple is contacted by a painful feeling, he feels one feeling, a bodily one, not a mental one. Being contacted by that same painful feeling, he harbours no aversion towards it. Since he harbours no aversion towards painful feeling, the underlying tendency to aversion towards painful feeling does not lie behind this. Being contacted by painful feeling, he does not seek delight in sensual pleasures. For what reason? Because the instructed noble disciple knows of an escape from painful feeling other than sensual pleasure. Since he does not seek delight in sensual pleasure, the underlying tendency to lust for pleasant feeling does not lie behind this. He understands, as it really is, the origin and the passing away, the gratification, the danger, and the escape in this case of these feelings. Since he understands these things, the underlying tendency to ignorance in regard to neither painful nor pleasant feeling does not lie behind this. If he feels a pleasant feeling, he feels it detached. If he feels a painful feeling, he feels it detached. If he feels a neither painful nor pleasant feeling, he feels it detached. This bhikkhu is called the noble disciple who is detached from birth, aging and death, who is detached from sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief and despair, who is detached from suffering, I say. This bhikkhu is the distinction, the disparity, the difference between the instructed noble disciple and the uninstructed worldling. So briefly, just to elaborate on that, having a body as a human being, it is inevitable that there will be painful feelings arising from time to time. That is part of the inheritance of having a body like this and being a feeling being. That is one of the characteristics of human beings, sentient beings, is that they feel. And not understanding that feelings are produced by causes and conditions, and that they are impermanent, and that they are unstable, we grasp after the pleasant feelings and we push away the unpleasant feelings. And because our mind is constantly in turmoil because of the feelings that arise through our experience, we are unable to, the mind is unable to be sensitive enough to be with the more subtle feelings that are neither grossly pleasant or grossly unpleasant, the more neutral feelings. So the tendency to ignorance also is reinforced in just our usual way of dealing with feelings. Now we're going to go on to in the Majjhima Nikaya to look at the way that we engage with the world through the sense bases and sense consciousness and sense contact. But it's very important to know that when we're talking about this phenomenon, this experience, the way that it's produced, what it ultimately produces is feeling. And it's the felt experience that we are reacting to, with like or dislike, depending on whether it's pleasant or unpleasant. And as we, in this particular chapter of the Samyutta Nikaya, in the next section called the Sick Ward, the Buddha points out that the feelings which arise when we are noticing, they arise dependent on the body. And this will be revealed even more in the Majjhima Nikaya. And the body itself is impermanent. So if we need this body in order to feel, and the body itself is impermanent, then the feelings that arise dependent on the body must also be impermanent. And seeing their impermanence is the escape from them. The gratification in pleasant feeling is that it's pleasant, it's liked, it's chased after, we want more. The danger is that we have to keep chasing after the objects to produce the feelings, because both, well, we know that the feeling is impermanent, that it doesn't last. And we're going to look in the Majjhima Nikaya that not only the feeling, not only the body, but the objects that produce these feelings are also impermanent, and they're uncertain. We mightn't be able to get them, the same objects, again, or we might be fed up with the objects so they don't produce the pleasant feelings anymore. So when we have this body, we're going to be subject to feeling, but because the body is impermanent, the feelings are also impermanent. And in the next section, in this section of the Samyutta Nikaya, the Buddha makes the point that the process that gives rise to feeling, that is our engagement with the external world, which we're going to go into in more detail in the Majjhimanikaya Sutta, the contact that takes place between the internal world and the external world, that also arises dependent on causes and conditions. And it is also impermanent and unreliable. It also changes. And so anything that arises in dependence on that contact has to be uncertain and unreliable because it's subject to change. And this is the escape from pleasant feeling, to recognize that not only does it have to be repeated, but it's unreliable because it's subject to change. And then in the final section of this Sanyutta Nikaya chapter, it talks about, because these three feelings are impermanent, conditioned, dependently arisen, subject to destruction, subject to vanishing, subject to fading away, subject to cessation. What three? Pleasant feeling, painful feeling, neither painful nor pleasant feeling. These three feelings are impermanent, conditioned, dependently arisen, subject to destruction, subject to vanishing, subject to fading away, subject to cessation. Now, in the teachings in this particular chapter on feelings, the Buddha outlines how we start to become mindful of the arising of feelings, become aware of how they are produced, and then we observe them and see that they do not last, that they do change, that they aren't permanent, they can't be guaranteed, they're uncertain, and that we actually observe this moment by moment. And this is the way that we start to resist the pull towards pleasant feeling, to try and maximize it, and to get away from the unpleasant feeling. We understand this unpleasant feeling is also impermanent, produced, conditioned, subject to change, falling away, disintegrating, fading. And that is our escape from the tyranny of painful feeling. While we have this body, while we're in contact with the world, painful feeling is certain to arise. But it has the nature also to pass away. So depending on how we take this whole process apart, whether we focus on the feeling itself, whether we focus on the body, whether we focus on the contact, whether we focus on the objects, the contemplation that we need to do, the insight that we need to have is the same. All of the elements of this whole process are all impermanent. They're all conditioned. They're all produced. They're all subject to change. They're all going towards destruction. They're all going towards fading away. And once we see that with insight and we stop grasping at them, then we not only experience in that moment the freedom from them, but we don't continue to feed the underlying tendency to lust for pleasant feeling and aversion towards the painful feeling, and then the ignorance about neither pleasant nor unpleasant feeling. And then, as we're going to see in the sutta, the import of this particular teaching in the Majjhima Nikaya is to show how the development of the mind in meditation provides a substitute for the usual source of our pleasant feelings. And as I said in the reading on the Dart, the uninstructed worldly disciple knows no other way to cope with unpleasant feeling than by pursuing pleasant feeling, and knows no way to obtain a pleasant feeling except through sensual gratification. But when we take up the spiritual path, we start to find a resource of access to pleasant feeling, which comes not through sensual gratification, but through the development of the mind. So now we will start on the teaching itself on the Majjhima Nikaya. So are there any questions so far? Have I made my point clear about what we're trying to see? So in this particular sutta, we won't be talking so much about feeling, but we have to realise that feeling is the next step along. So, Majjhima Nikaya 137. Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was living at Sarvati in Jeta's Grove, Anathapindika's park. There he addressed the bhikkhus thus. Bhikkhus, Venerable Sir, they replied. The Blessed One said this. Bhikkhus, I shall teach you an exposition of the sixfold base. Listen and attend closely to what I shall say. Yes, Venerable Sir, the bhikkhus replied. The Blessed One said, the six internal bases should be understood. The six external bases should be understood. The six classes of consciousness should be understood. The six classes of contact should be understood. The 18 kinds of mental exploration should be understood. The 36 positions of beings should be understood. Therein, by depending on this, abandon that. There are three foundations of mindfulness that the Noble One cultivates, cultivating which the Noble One is a teacher fit to instruct a group. Among the teachers of training, it is he that is called the incomparable leader of persons to be tamed. This is the summary of the exposition of the sixfold base. So we're going to see what all of that means. The six internal bases should be understood. So it was said, and with reference to what was this said. There are the eye base, the ear base, the nose base, the tongue base, the body base, and the mind base. So it is with reference to this that it was said the six internal bases should be understood. And in the teaching from the Sangyutta Nikaya, we talked about the body. This feeling has arisen dependent on the body. And the six internal bases, the six sense bases, are on the body. They are part of the body. And so they are the way in which we receive the external stimuli. And each base functions according to its own particular object. Or range of objects. So the tongue only deals with flavours. The nose only deals with odours. The nose doesn't hear sounds. The tongue doesn't see forms. So each base is exclusive to its own range and its own objects. The six external bases should be understood. So it was said. And with reference to what was this said, there are the form base, the sound base, the odour base, the flavour base, the tangible base, and the mind base, mind object base. So it was with reference to this that it was said the six external bases should be understood. These external bases are the objects in the environment that the internal bases come in contact with. So the eye sees forms, the nose smells odours, the ear hears vibrations. And this is something to contemplate and to reflect on, that the forms are just shape and colour. The sounds are just vibrations. The odours are just particles which actually make a touch contact with the sense organ. And they are received internally into our personal environment, into our internal environment, through those sense bases. But it's not the sense base which understands them and distinguishes them or classifies them. That happens in the mind. So we can notice this when we're very, very still in our meditation and there's a sound in the environment, that if the mind is still, that a sound is simply a vibration that registers because the hearing consciousness arises because there is the object, the sense base which is working, and the condition of being able to hear because of there's no background noise that's excluding that sound. We're not deaf. The volume of the vibrations is sufficient for us to register it. That makes the hearing consciousness arise. But the hearing consciousness doesn't understand what it is that's made contact. We go through to the next paragraph. The six classes of consciousness should be understood. So it was said, and with reference to what was this said. There are eye consciousness, ear consciousness, nose consciousness, tongue consciousness, body consciousness, and mind consciousness. So mind consciousness is dealing with thoughts, with thinking, whether it's about something happening now or something that's happened in the past or that mightn't have happened but is coming in the future and we're planning about it or thinking about it. So it was with reference to this that it was said the six classes of consciousness should be understood. So the internal base, the external base and the sense consciousness that goes along with that base and that object. And when the three come together, then there is contact. And this is the point at which the these three produce contact, and contact engages the mind in identifying that object, classifying that object, but also feeling in response to that object. The six classes of contact should be understood. So it was said, and with reference to what was this said. There are the eye contact, ear contact, nose contact, tongue contact, body contact, and mind contact. So it was with reference to this that it was said, the six classes of contact should be understood. Now, contact is the necessary condition for feeling to arise. And that contact can be that we think of something and that mind, object, consciousness gives rise to a contact which is gives rise to a feeling. So it doesn't always come from outside in that the object is outside. The object can be a thought in our own mind. But generally speaking, the sense bases and the sense object, the sense bases are internal, the objects are external, and it's the coming together of those two worlds, first through the sense consciousness, appropriate for that base and that object. And then when those three come together, contact takes place And that's when the mind is activated to make sense of what's happening, to give it some sort of classification, some sort of identification, which we call perception or sanya, and then we feel it. That's the Vedana. And the Vedana is pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. The Buddha actually gives many more classifications for feeling, but these are the three basic ones. Are there any questions?
With regard to lack of contact with the outside world, where one is drawing from memory, so that is mind consciousness triggering, there is the contact with memory and mind consciousness connecting with mind consciousness, or the memory.
The memory is a different function of the mind, if you like, the sanya. But the mind has to have an object. So when we're not engaging with external sensory objects, then that's when we'll throw up a thought about something, because it can't be without an object in the ordinary state of consciousness. So when there's nothing happening that it has to attend to, that's when it starts to draw on its supply of thoughts. And so then that whole process goes again, where there's the thought comes up. We may deliberately think of something, or it may just come up, but it's always accompanied by a feeling. But we don't normally, unless it's a strong feeling, we're not sensitive enough to that. Yes, there's contact with the mind, making contact with the mind object, which is the thought. So the consciousness is mind consciousness, which is different from or distinct from, once contact has taken place, then the whole train of thought of process that is then put in then starts as we try to understand and make sense of that thought that's arisen. So the first mind, the mind consciousness is like hearing consciousness. It's just registering a vibration on the ear base, which is functions to register vibrations in the environment as sounds. But it's not distinguishing the sound or understanding the sound. It's only after the ear base, the object, the vibration, and sense consciousness that it's possible for that to be heard, that the mind then comes in and understands what it is that's been heard based on its previous experience with things like that. That's where the perception comes in. So we're drawing on our past knowledge to distinguish what that is. Now, when a thought arises, there's first of all just the mind consciousness is simply that part of the mind which is able to register a thought as an object, to know that something's been triggered. It's not a vibration that's triggering the ear and it's setting off the whatever's inside the ear that does all that. It's whatever's in the mind that registers thoughts.
Is that memory?
No. No, it's simply memory comes later when it distinguishes what that particular thought is about. And if you come to a point of more subtlety and refinement in the mind, you will feel the arising of a thought as something that you can be aware of, like it's coming. It's something that's actually it's apprehended at that time, as there wasn't and now there is. The arising is recognized, and the way that you were you actually are in touch with that arising is through the feeling which accompanies it. It's pre-verbal, that it's that happens slightly, if you could see it, if you could. The contact gives rise to the feeling. So the feeling, although it seems to be at the same moment, is triggered as a result of the contact. But the mind is, this is why we can't sort of experience this directly most of the time, is because the mind is arising and falling away with such rapidity. So even while we're sitting here, it seems that we're seeing and hearing and feeling the touch in the body all at one time. That's our experience. It's like in the movie, you know, everything is, the frames are speeded up so much that it looks like it's one continuous picture, but actually it's frame after frame after frame that's being it's going through the lens. And it's the same with our mind, that these, we're talking about mind moments which are infinitesimally small, but the more that we start to become aware of them and become sensitive to them, and the more quiet that there is in the mind, we can notice this arising, and we can notice this quiet, and we can notice how when there's not anything happening that's coming, that's so strongly coloured by our past experience with it. So, for example, we can be watching the breath, and the breath is quite innocuous and peaceful and calm and doesn't have a great emotional flavour of it. And we can notice that. And then we can notice, I thought about something, and there's actually an uprising of the whole organism at that time. So you become more sensitive to this, the impact of thinking on the organism. Just like the impact of when the mind is very quiet, there's a certain point in the meditation where a sound seems magnified and you jump. But then you go further and there's a point when you're very peaceful and quiet and the sound is heard as though it's at a great distance and it doesn't touch you, doesn't touch the body because everything's quiet and down. So there are different sort of changes of the sensitivity of the organism as the mind quietens down. So at a point everything is heightened, then at another point everything is calmed. Yes. Yes.
I remember that. the sound of the bell in my mind is speaking to me. I'm 3 steps behind what you see.
Yes. Something like that. Yes. Yes. Contact is the prerequisite for feeling. Contact through the senses. Contact through the senses. So it doesn't have to be that we've experienced that before and we're dredging up an exact memory of that thing. But even hearing consciousness that is of something that we don't even have any idea what it is, but we still recognize it as a sound. Yes, yes, yeah. So what the point of trying to sort of show this process is that at any point in the process we can apply the same investigation of is this arising on its own? Is this arising independently? Can this part of the process exist independent of supporting causes and conditions? And whatever it is that's arisen, is it going to last forever? So even if we look at the internal bases, the ear base or the eye base on the body is not going to last forever. And some of our sense bases will be wearing out long before the rest of the body wears out. So our hearing deteriorates. So whatever point we apply the reflections on that I mentioned, that these are produced and they're changing and they're uncertain, we can see the same sort of truth applying. Now, the 18 kinds of mental exploration should be understood, so it was said, and with reference to what was this said. Now, the mental exploration takes place after the sense contact. This is the part of the process which we refer to as sankhara, and it's the proliferation in the mind around the objects that we've come in contact with. And this is very important to reflect on and to explore in your own experience. Where do we proliferate? Do we proliferate around the experience or around the ear base or whatever? No, we mostly proliferate around the object, the external object. We're so conditioned to always be looking outside ourselves and seeing that's where the source of our happiness is to be found and that's where the source of our suffering is coming from. So the 18 kinds of mental exploration. On seeing a form with the eye, one explores a form productive of joy. One explores a form productive of grief. One explores a form productive of equanimity. I'll explain all this, but on hearing a sound with the ear, on smelling an odour with the nose, on tasting a flavour with the tongue, on touching a tangible with the body, on cognizing a mind object with the mind, one explores a mind object productive of joy. One explores a mind object productive of grief. One explores a mind object productive of equanimity. Thus, there are these six kinds of exploration with joy, six kinds of exploration with grief, and six kinds of exploration with equanimity. So it was with reference to this that it was said the 18 kinds of mental explorations should be understood. So according to each sense base, and the objects that come in contact through that sense base, there is this exploration around the object. Do we like it or not? Do we want it or not? Does it make us happy or not? Do we want to get another one because it made us happy before? How will we get another one? Where will we get another one? How much will another one cost? And then the exploration around the things that cause us grief. We don't want one of those. They cost too much. We like it, but they make us miserable because we can't have it. That's the point of it. We'd like to get another one, but we can't get it now. We'll have to get it later. And if we're going to get that one, well, we can't have that one. That sort of thing that goes on and on and on. And the one that's productive of equanimity maybe is the one that we don't really have strong feelings about either way. We can be encouraged to have strong feelings, and that's the role of advertising. That's what other people do to us when they say, oh, you should get one of these too. And then we think, oh, yes, I should. Or don't bother with this one. This is a real dud. And then we think, oh, yeah, I'm not going to let that one go. So this is a sort of mental exploration around these objects. And according to the senses, these are the objects are related to the sense bases. And then we have these three kinds of attitudes towards them, and you can see how much effort goes into this kind of mental exploration, how much time and energy we put into researching just which is the right one and why we think that one is the good one and all of that. And again, we're thinking about the object out there and how this object is the source of our happiness or the source of our suffering, but it's actually related to the way that it makes us feel. That was the word I was trying to remember and I couldn't. Each of them has their own domain.
That's right. So, but then in the end, as we experience something, it's a little bit like eating a fruit salad. You've got a bit of this, a bit of that, a bit of that.
Yes.
Each of them in their own domains, but they all form an experience of what is on the spoon as it goes in the mouth.
Yes.
And so for us, we have a total imprint, which is a mixture.
Yes.
We don't
Well, what actually happens, and this is good that you've brought up the analogy of the bowl of fruit salad as being like all of the different senses. Are they all indistinguishable from each other and do they mix together so that they're all like one? Actually, Achyam Brahm used this image to try to explain how even in that bowl of fruit salad, there is one fruit which occurs with everyone. And that is after the sense object has been taken up by the sense consciousness that's appropriate to it, even if it's a thought rising from within the mind, there is then the mind which deals with that particular sense contact and goes through the whole process of recognizing it, distinguishing it, which is the perception, feeling in relation to it, and deciding whether it's a good or a bad one, we want it or we don't want it, how we're going to deal with it. And in the analogy that Achyam Brahm gave was that whatever fruit you say, if it's a coconut or a banana, if you've got a peach, you've got the peach and then you've got the banana. If you've got an apple, then you've got the apple and then you've got the banana. So the banana is going to accompany all of the different fruits. But the experience of it is that they all come together and we say that's what a fruit salad tastes like. And we mightn't be able to distinguish the individual fruits. Just as at this moment we are seeing and hearing, we may even be smelling, we may be feeling the temperature, we may be feeling all sorts of things, and it seems like it's just me feeling or experiencing this.
Is it one knowing or six knowing? In other words, is the merging, the sensory, sense bases come together to get one knowing of a combined package, or do you get six knowing to sort of get through salivary?
You would get all the individuals, and then you would get a knowing, which is based on, this is a fruit salad. So then it would combine it. So if you're in a situation, say for example, when you come into this room, every sense is going to be registering according to its domain, whether there's incense on, whether it's too hot and you feel it in the body, whether the light's dazzling you from behind. There would be all of that, and then there would, after all of that's registered, which may be a split second, would then be, oh, it's nice today. Now I'm at the, I'm so glad to be here. Or, oh, why they got to... Who didn't turn on the fans? That the whole experience would come together to produce something like that. And so you might have had a pleasant feeling coming from your being, you've arrived here, but you've got an unpleasant feeling because it's too hot. So whichever is dominant at that time. So it's arising and passing away very rapidly, but just its compactness makes it seem as though it's one thing. Yes, the mind is the one that's understanding it, yes.
So the continuity of feeling, that's the thing.
The feeling is arising and passing away, arising and passing away. But what happens is that whatever's experienced in the mind is as a feeling, even that mental feeling of pleasure or pain, expresses itself in the body as sensation. And so a feeling that is triggered, and now that they're doing all the studies on the chemicals in the brain and which part of the brain is activated in this situation, and then what it triggers off in the next part of the brain and the chemicals that they produce, all of that being set in motion may take seconds to actually dissipate from the body. And so, for example, if you're in a situation of extreme fear, you can just feel adrenaline shoot through the body. But after the experience of it shooting through, then there's also the moment when it's being absorbed into the body and going back into the bloodstream and we excrete it or whatever happens to it. And so that takes a longer period of time to pass away. And that's why there's this intermixing of feelings, pleasant and unpleasant, pleasant and pleasant and pleasant and unpleasant, but whichever one is overrides the others, there's this mixture of feelings going on.
Is that what we
take for the sense of self? We can identify with it. That's when we might think I'm successful because I've got pleasant feeling, or we might think I'm failing because I'm having unpleasant feeling again, painful feeling, not wanted feeling. So unless we really notice what's going on, the point is that we will always think that it's the object outside us that's making us successful or unsuccessful, but it's that feeling inside us which is really what we're identifying with. The feeling that arises is already a karma vipaka. It's our old karma fruiting. So how we have related to that thing in the past is how we will relate to it now. And that's where there's the continuity. In the present moment, the way we make new karma is, and this is what this whole teaching is trying to direct us to, if we are sensitive to what is happening, to the nature, to the feeling has been produced, and the feeling is of this kind, it feels like this, then once with the trained disciple feels a painful feeling, and it is painful, but it's just a painful feeling. Painful feeling means unwanted, disliked, not something that we want to repeat. A pleasant feeling is one that is liked and we want to repeat it. So in the present moment, the feeling that arises with any sense contact is dependent on what we've experienced in the past. And then how we relate to it now is the new karma that we make. So in this particular sutta, we're looking at more distant from that actual experience of the feeling, looking at being able to say no to the object and recognizing that the object is impermanent and uncertain and is going to disintegrate. But in the way that we practice is to see the feeling is like that. So in the moment when it arises, whether it's pleasant or unpleasant, we know it simply as a passing phenomenon that we don't have to attach to, that we can, once we develop sufficient mindfulness with equanimity, just be aware of it in the moment. And even if it's a painful feeling, like when we're sitting in meditation and our leg is really hurting, that we just know painful feeling. And particularly if we make the mind calm enough and strong enough, it's has sufficient spaciousness in it to hold that feeling and not be disturbed by it. And when a pleasant feeling comes, to simply notice a pleasant feeling has arisen. But this pleasant feeling is dependent on causes and conditions. It's not mine. I don't own it. And so if I grasp onto it now, I'm going to be bound to it next time it arises. That's the ignorance, when we don't understand this process. Is that making sense? The 36 positions of beings should be understood. We're on verse number 9. So it was said, and with reference to what was this said? There are 6 kinds of joy based on the household life and 6 kinds of joy based on renunciation. There are 6 kinds of grief based on the household life and 6 kinds of grief based on renunciation. There are 6 kinds of equanimity based on the household life and 6 kinds of equanimity based on renunciation. Herein, what are the 6 kinds of joy based on the household life? When one regards as an acquisition the acquisition of forms cognizable by the eye that are wished for, desired, agreeable, gratifying, and associated with worldliness, or when one recalls what was formerly acquired that has passed, ceased, and changed, joy arises. Such joy as this is called joy based on the household life. When one regards as an acquisition the acquisition of sounds cognizable by the eye, the acquisition of odors cognizable by the nose, the acquisition of flavors cognizable by the tongue, the acquisition of tangibles cognizable by the body, the acquisition of mind objects cognizable by the mind that are wished for, desired, agreeable, gratifying, and associated with worldliness, or when one recalls what was formerly acquired that has passed, ceased, and changed, joy arises. Such joy as this is called joy based on the household life. These are the 6 kinds of joy based on the household life. So when we acquire an object, and if we think of not just acquiring it, going out and buying it, but if we just hear it, or we just smell it, the beautiful perfume of the flowers in the garden, we acquire it at that moment, and our tendency is to indulge in it and to enjoy it and to think of it, if we've bought it, that it's mine, or the flowers we've grown are producing that beautiful fragrance, and we rejoice in that. Or we might remember the beautiful wine we had last time we went to so-and-so's place, food we had, that we're not having it now, but we remember when we were delighted with it. And that's the kind of joy that is the joy of the household life, the joy of sensual gratification. And that's the sort of joy that people have available to them and which they are dependent on for their happiness. So that's the normal sort of worldly joy, and which is, if we pursue that kind of joy, that source of happiness, then we continue to run after sensual gratification. Herein, what are the 6 kinds of joy based on renunciation? When by knowing the impermanence, change, fading away, and cessation of forms, one sees as it actually is with proper wisdom, that forms both formerly and now are all impermanent, suffering, and subject to change, joy arises, such joy as this is called joy on renunciation. when by knowing the impermanence, change, fading away and cessation of sounds, of odours, of flavours, of tangibles, of mind objects, one sees as it actually is, with proper wisdom, that mind objects, both formerly and now, are all impermanent, suffering and subject to change, joy arises. Such joy as this is called joy based on renunciation. These are the six kinds of joy based on renunciation. So in the commentary, this says that this is the joy that arises when insight is being practiced, and when through the development of one's meditation practice, one is able to experience directly that everything that's arising is also changing and fading away. And so this is maybe an experience that we've had directly in the meditation, for example, even if you're not practicing insight practice directly, but when the mind is very still, you can recognize the arising of a sound particularly that comes into being, stays for a while and fades away. And you can notice, if the mind is very still, that a thought arises, comes into being, stays for a while and passes away. That an odour that comes into being, arises, stays for a while and passes away. A physical feeling in the body, very often painful feelings, once the mind is still, we can notice that this feeling arises, stays for a while and passes away. And once we become familiar with that, the nature of objects, it's not only the joy that arises when we are in the meditation itself and seeing things as they are, but because of seeing that, and this is the mindfulness with clear comprehension, one sees the implications of that, that this thing which I'm basing my happiness on is uncertain, is subject to change, is likely to pass away and no longer be there to provide me with the source of happiness that it was providing. And so one starts to not be so infatuated with these things which we know are impermanent. And by knowing the true nature of these things, it doesn't mean that we cut all the flowers out of our garden because we know that they're going to fade, but we don't expect that they will last beyond their nature. We don't get disappointed when they fade, when they no longer smell as nice or look as nice. We no longer reacting to the nature of things in the same way, expecting that they're going to be permanently available as a source of happiness for us. And as we accept them in their true nature, then they can be as they are, and we're not so bound to them in our ups and downs, expecting more from them than they can give. They can be pleasant, but they will also fade away. So the renunciation comes not only when we can renounce the object, but when we renounce the attachment to the object. And this is where we're talking about a change that is happening subtly over time. Not talking about something that arises once and for all and that's it. It's enough for us to renounce the things where we've previously been counting on for our happiness. But over time we start to see the true nature of these objects. And as I said, in this particular teaching, in this particular sutta, we're looking at the things outside in the world. But the crux of the whole thing comes down to the feelings that they produce within us. So when we really attach to things, we get a strong feeling of happiness, elation, when we come in contact with them, and strong disappointment when they don't do what we want them to do. Our disappointment at them is much stronger when we don't understand their true nature. But as we understand their true nature, the feeling of elation is not as strong, and the feeling of despair is not as strong, because we're not expecting the same things from them to the same extent as we did before. Yes. So the question or the comment is about, yes, you can be detached from objects like flowers or cars or whatever, but the attachment to loved ones, parents or very close relatives, and the grief that you feel when they die is much more difficult to free oneself from and to see in this with subjectivity. And yes, that's true, and that's why we understand this is a gradual training, and we work at the points where we can find an entrance point into the whole thing. And if we keep reminding ourselves over and over again by observing the flowers in the garden, by observing that things that we've spent a lot of effort over getting the money to buy them or whatever, they are going to change, and they do change even during the course of the life that we're using them with. We're gradually familiarizing ourselves with that truth. You know, this is one of the fundamental characteristics of all existence: impermanence. And the suffering, which is the next universal characteristic, arises because we give those things that we like or that we're attached to a meaning or a quality that they don't have. We expect them to last forever. And that's the suffering. So we keep reminding ourselves of that. And gradually, little by little, it starts to sink in. Yes. Oh, well, yes, it's very complex for all of us. But again, I think if we look at it, when we're talking about the complexity of feelings for people and in relationships, I think part of what we can see is our karmic inheritance, which puts us into a more or less conflicting or complex situations in our relationships, which evokes even stronger reactions. And I think part of our, or what I understand and what helps me, is to see that if we keep practicing, gradually we get into less complex situations. And even our, karmically speaking, we're not born into situations where we experience trauma that, you know, stays with us for the whole of our life. And that's, you know, our relationships with the people who are close to us are much more straightforward. So I think that that's also part of it. And so if we don't, you know, if we're patient and we just understand we have to work where we are, we know maybe theoretically what we're looking for and how it's in ultimate sense is, but we have to work where we are. And if we've got this strong, complex set of relationships or this strong attachment, we just have to work with that. So So up to verse 12. Herein, what are the six kinds of grief based on the household life? When one regards as a non-acquisition the non-acquisition of forms cognizable by the eye that are wished for, desired, agreeable, gratifying, and associated with worldliness, or when one recalls what was formerly not acquired that was has passed, ceased, and changed, grief arises. Such grief as this is called grief based on the household life. When one regards as a non-acquisition the non-acquisition of sounds cognizable by the ear, the non-acquisition of odours cognizable by the nose, the non-acquisition of flavours cognizable by the tongue, the non-acquisition of tangibles cognizable by the body, the non-acquisition of mind objects cognizable by the mind that are wished for, desired, agreeable, gratifying, and associated with worldliness, or when one recalls what was formerly not acquired, that has passed, ceased, and changed, grief arises. Such grief as this is called grief based on the household life. These are the six kinds of grief based on the household life. So it's not just that things change that we get that we want, but we don't get the things that we want. And the opportunity for getting them changes. So we missed out on that great job. Or we missed out on that that tip on the shares or the horses or whatever it was, and we didn't have the chance to cash in on them, and so we missed out on that kind of thing that we would have been nice, but we didn't have it. And so the grief arises because of that. So verse 13, herein, what are the six kinds of grief based on renunciation? When by knowing the impermanence, change, fading away and cessation of forms, one sees as it actually is with proper wisdom that forms both formerly and now are all impermanent, suffering and subject to change, one generates a longing for the supreme liberations thus. When shall I enter upon and abide in that base that the noble ones now enter upon and abide in? One who generates thus a longing for the supreme liberations, grief arises, and with that longing as condition. Such grief as this is called grief based on renunciation. So what we're talking about here is that we start to see that it's true, this impermanence, this unsatisfactoriness, this uncontrollability of the things that we formerly thought we could find happiness with. We see that that's true. Whether it's an object that we see, or one that we hear, one that we smell, one that we taste, one that we touch, one that we feel or think about, that we see that all of these do have the nature to be ultimately unsatisfying. And yet we don't have anything else to replace that with. We have no other source of happiness, but we've heard about the source of happiness that's from within the mind itself. And we've heard about these deep states of meditation. The supreme liberations are that they're talking about is talking about the jhanas, and that in those jhanas, and this is one of the important points to understand, those jhanas are accompanied by feeling, by pleasant feeling. And so it's not that we are trying to get rid of all feeling or even all pleasant feeling. What we're doing in the development of the mind in this spiritual path is to access a source of pleasant feeling which doesn't rely on outer conditions, on acquisition of objects, on circumstances being the way that we'd like them to be. And that the feeling that arises dependent on meditation in any of the jhanas is also impermanent, but it's a feeling which is pleasant and which with the development of the mind can be accessed and becomes a replacement for the kind of worldly feeling that we've been pursuing. And because it's not a feeling dependent on sensual gratification, it doesn't feed the underlying tendency to lust for sensual gratification. So it starts to take the fuel away from our striving and running after things in the world. And because it's something that is accessible to us, regardless of conditions in the world, then when there's an unpleasant feeling and we have ceased to feed the tendency to lust after pleasant feeling as a way to avoid unpleasant feeling, we're much more able to just abide with that unpleasant feeling as it is, because the mind has enough buoyancy and peace and inner strength to just be with that feeling without needing to run away from it. And because the tendency towards lusting for pleasant feeling or aversion towards unpleasant feeling is not then fed, then these underlying tendencies are starting to be weakened. So as we progress, these underlying tendencies don't so easily get triggered in our daily life by what we experience. The things that we encounter don't lead to such elation if they're pleasant, and such despair if they're unpleasant, because we have this inner strength in the mind, and also because we're not reinforcing the tendencies in the mind through our everyday behaviour. Now, this longing for being able to access these deep meditations, the longing itself isn't what leads to this stability, but because of the longing, one is then inspired to practice, and not just to practice meditation, but to do all of the things necessary to develop the mind in meditation. So that's not just the meditation itself, it's the sila part of the path of practice, the virtues part, and then it's using the wisdom aspect also to see more clearly the true nature of things. So one is inspired to put forth effort to cultivate the path and to attain these deep meditations. Herein, what are the six kinds of equanimity based on the household life? On seeing a form with the eye, equanimity arises in a foolish, infatuated, ordinary person, in an untaught ordinary person who has not conquered his limitations or conquered the results of action and who is blind to danger. Such equanimity as this does not transcend the form. That is why it is called equanimity based on the household life. So this means that we can be equanimous to things, not because we have a true understanding of their nature, that they're uncertain and impermanent and they'll fade away. They can't be a source of lasting happiness. But it may be just that we're not interested in that thing, and so we don't pursue it. So if someone says to us, how about coming to the motorbike races, and we have no real interest in the motorbike races, then we can say, oh no, I'm not, I can't be bothered. Or it's not that we're really averse to it, but it's not something that interests us. And so it's not that we understand the nature of that whole experience, but it's just that it doesn't grab us. And so that's the equanimity of the household life based on any of the sense contacts that we can have. Herein, what are the six kinds of equanimity based on renunciation? When by knowing the impermanence, change, fading away and cessation of forms, one sees as it actually is, with proper wisdom, that forms both formerly and now are all impermanent, suffering and subject to change, equanimity arises. Such equanimity as this transcends the form. That is why it is called equanimity based on renunciation. So it doesn't matter how enticing the thing appears to be, how much in the past we would have been knocked over by it. Now it doesn't move us. And now we've transcended the form. That is that we see its true nature. And this is whether it's pleasant or unpleasant. So we can abide with it as it is without trying to make it be the way that we would like it to be for our own happiness. And having transcended the form, then equanimity arises. So that is the same with all sense objects, that with proper wisdom we know them. Because we don't, we've been often just gradually ceasing to run after them in the same way that we did in the past, then the strength of our desire for them weakens until gradually, because we have understood them as they are, we can remain unmoved by them. The question is about if you challenge an addiction in one area, will it simply arise in another? Or is this sense restraint that one applies, is it going to be helpful across the board? Yes and no. So if there's only restraint based on refraining from, that is not based on deep wisdom and understanding the nature of the object, then when the object is sufficiently attractive, or when you're in a vulnerable state, then yes, you'll still be pulled in by it. That's the difference between being able to resist something because you have something at stake, or a buoyant mind, or it's not as attractive as it used to be, or whatever. And seeing it with wisdom and knowing it, its true nature. So the wisdom aspect is what really liberates us from our bondage or attachment to that object. But by the same token, if we practice sense restraint and we refrain from feeding our old habit patterns, then we do weaken the tendency just to follow old habit patterns of the same kind. So if we know that at a particular time of day we feel particularly tired, and when we feel particularly tired, we're more likely to go and look for something to give us a lift, whether it's physically we want to have some sugar, or we want to do something that we like so that we don't get a bit of energy in the mind or whatever. If we start to become familiar with that pattern and that process, and we learn to work with it more skillfully, not just restraining ourselves at that point, but understanding the process and seeing what we can do to not feel so tired or so worn out at that moment, then right across the board that helps us, that restraint helps us to start to see how we can do that in other areas of our life. Because the waves that we're creating in the mind, the disturbances, are not as big, and so it's more manageable. And then as we stop feeding the underlying tendency to looking for something nice to get rid of an unpleasant feeling, we're not feeding the underlying tendency to the lust for pleasant feeling or to the aversion to unpleasant feeling. That is what helps us across the board. So it was with reference to this that it was said the 36 positions of beings should be understood. So that is the joy and the renunciation through all of the sense bases in the household life, and the joy that's possible, and then the renunciation of that dependence. Therein, by depending on this, abandon that, so it was said, and with reference to what was this said. Here, because by depending and relying on the six kinds of joy based on renunciation, abandon and surmount the six kinds of joy based on the household life. It is thus they are abandoned, it is thus they are surmounted. By depending and relying on the six kinds of grief based on renunciation, abandon and surmount the six kinds of grief based on the household life. It is thus they are abandoned, and it is thus they are surmounted. By depending and relying on the six kinds of equanimity based on renunciation, abandon and surmount the six kinds of equanimity based on the household life. It is thus they are abandoned. It is thus they are surmounted. So we are understanding things, the true nature of things, the objects, the contacts, the feelings, seeing how they can't bring us lasting satisfaction. It's their nature to change. That's one thing. And then through slowly understanding that, we don't pursue things in the way that we even renounce the things which we might still find quite agreeable. And in the past, we would have just pursued thoughtlessly. Now we can say no, even though we would still be drawn to them. And then eventually, by seeing their true nature clearly, we lose all interest in them. That's one side. Then the other side is that we also start to cultivate the mind in meditation, and we start to experience the happiness from the developed mind through meditation. And that becomes a replacement for the joy that we were depending on through sensual pleasure. By depending and relying on the six kinds of joy based on renunciation, abandon and surmount the six kinds of grief based on renunciation. So once we see that there is something to be gained from meditation, then we have this feeling, oh, I want it, but we understand we can't just have it through wanting it. We have to produce the right conditions. We start to do that, and so we no longer have just the longing, but we actually have the results of the practice. There is bhikkhus equanimity that is diversified based on diversity, and there is equanimity that is unified based on unity. And what bhikkhus is equanimity that is diversified based on diversity? There is equanimity regarding forms, sounds, odors, flavors, and tangibles. This bhikkhus is equanimity that is diversified based on diversity. So once we become more wise, and we're able to resist the lure of the things that we experience as sights, as sounds, as smells, as tastes, as touches, then that's the equanimity that is diversified, because it's over a whole range of objects, over a whole range of sensory experiences. And what bhikkhus is the equanimity that is unified based on unity? And this is the equanimity that is based on the unification of the mind through meditation. And this is through the various levels of development of mind in the form jhanas and the immaterial jhanas. So there is equanimity regarding the base of infinite space, the base of infinite consciousness, the base of nothingness, the base of neither perception nor non-perception. This bhikkhus is equanimity that is unified based on unity. So there is no sensory object in that, no sense stimulation, no going out through the sense doors. The mind is completely unified within itself. Here, because by depending and relying on equanimity that is unified based on unity, abandon and surmount equanimity that is diversified based on diversity. It is thus this is abandoned. It is thus this is surmounted. Bhikkhus, by depending and relying on non-identification, abandon and surmount equanimity that is unified based on unity. It is thus this is abandoned. It is thus this is surmounted. And so this depending and relying on non-identification is when one sees through the conceit of self. So even when one is meditating well, one may still think, I'm a good meditator. Look what I've developed. This meditation state, which is now accessible, we start to think of as our personal property, and it starts to build up our conceit. So once we see through that, we see that this is arising because of a process through necessary causes and conditions being present, that it is impermanent, that it changes, that it doesn't last, it's not my personal property, then we have no identification with it, and that's a further freedom. So we don't get elated through our meditation attainments, and we don't get disappointed when we sit down for a meditation and we expected it to be blissful and it wasn't. Causes and conditions, not our personal property. So then we were able to become even equanimous to that. There are three foundations of mindfulness that are the noble one cultivates, cultivating which the noble one is a teacher fit to instruct. So it was said, and with reference to what was said. He, bhikkhus, compassionate and seeking their welfare, the teacher teaches the Dharma to the disciples out of compassion. This is for your welfare, this is for your happiness. His disciples do not want to hear or give ear or exert their minds to understand. They err and turn aside from the teacher's dispensation. With that, the Tathagata is not satisfied and feels no satisfaction. Yet he dwells unmoved, mindful and fully aware. This, bhikkhus, is the first foundation of mindfulness that the noble one cultivates, cultivating which the noble one is a teacher fit to instruct. So the Buddha gives the instructions and the disciples aren't interested. And that's amazing to hear, isn't it? The Buddha said, that happened to me. And so it's not satisfactory because he's giving the instructions and no one's practicing, but he's not moved by that because he's not taking it as a personal slight. Furthermore, bhikkhus, compassionate and seeking their welfare, the teacher teaches the Dharma to the disciples out of compassion. This is for your welfare, this is for your happiness. Some of his disciples will not hear or give ear or exert their minds to understand. They err and turn aside from the teacher's dispensation. Some of his disciples will hear and give ear and exert their minds to understand. They do not err, they do not turn aside from the teacher's dispensation. With that, the Tathagata is not satisfied and feels no satisfaction, and he is not dissatisfied and feels no dissatisfaction. Remaining free from both satisfaction and dissatisfaction, he dwells in equanimity, mindful and fully aware. This, bhikkhus, is called the second foundation of mindfulness that the noble one cultivates, cultivating which the noble one is a teacher fit to instruct. Furthermore, bhikkhus, compassionate and seeking their welfare, the teacher teaches the Dharma to the disciples out of compassion. This is for your welfare, this is for your happiness. His disciples will hear and give ear and exert their minds to understand, and they do not err and turn aside from the teacher's dispensation. With that, the Tathagata is satisfied and feels satisfaction, yet he dwells unmoved, mindful and fully aware. This, bhikkhus, is called the third foundation of mindfulness that the noble one cultivates, cultivating which the noble one is a teacher fit to instruct. So the teacher is satisfied when everyone's practicing, but he's also unmoved and mindful. So he has perfect equanimity. So it was with reference to this that it was said, there are these three foundations of mindfulness that the noble one cultivates, cultivating which the noble one is a teacher fit to instruct a group. Among the teachers of training, it is he that is called the incomparable leader of persons to be tamed, which is one of the things that we chant, is qualities of the Buddha. So it was said, and with reference to what?
guided by the elephant tamer, because the elephant to be tamed goes in one direction, east, west, north and south. Guided by the horse tamer, because the horse to be tamed goes in one direction, east, west, north or south. Guided by the ox tamer, because the ox to be tamed goes in one direction, east, west, north, south. Bhikkhus guided by the Tathagata, accomplished and fully enlightened, the person to be tamed goes in eight directions. And this is now talking about different ways that one cultivates meditation. The first one, possessed of material form, he sees forms. This is the first direction. And this talks about using an object internally for the basis of one's meditation. So, for example, the breath. Not perceiving forms internally, he sees forms externally. This is the second direction. So using a kasina or an object externally that one focuses on, and that becomes the object that becomes the object that takes precedence in the mind until it becomes the mental object as well. He's resolved only upon the beautiful. This is the third direction. And so this is the cultivation of the Brahma Viharas, Metta, Karuna, Mudita, Upekkha. And with the complete surmounting of perceptions of form and with the disappearance of sensory perceptions, with non-attention to perceptions of diversity, aware that space is infinite, he enters upon and abides in the base of infinite space. This is the fourth direction. By completely surmounting the base of infinite space, aware that consciousness is infinite, he enters upon and abides in the base of infinite consciousness. This is the fifth direction. By completely surmounting the base of infinite consciousness, aware that there is nothing, he enters upon and abides in the base of nothingness. This is the sixth direction. By completely surmounting the base of nothingness, he enters upon and abides in the base of neither perception nor non-perception. This is the seventh direction. By completely surmounting the base of neither perception nor non-perception, he enters and abides in the cessation of perception and feeling. This is the eighth direction. And that is the only point at which there is no feeling in all of these meditations. So talking about the development of the jhanas and progressively going up until the cessation, a nirodha, which is only available for the non-returner and the arahat. So we're talking here about very developed states of mind. But through all of these states of mind, there is still feeling. It is only feeling. There's no feeling in the cessation. Bhikkhus guided by the Tathagata, accomplished and fully enlightened, the person to be tamed goes in these eight directions. So it was with reference to this that it was said, among the teachers of training, it is he that is called the incomparable leader of persons to be tamed. That is what the Blessed One said. The bhikkhus were satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words. So ultimately what the Buddha is saying is that through meditation, you can find a source of happiness which facilitates and makes possible the renunciation of happiness through the household life. But in order to reach that point, there has to be the wisdom which starts to see through not only the objects, but the feelings which objects produce, those pleasant feelings which we strive after, and those unpleasant feelings which we resist. And so this is has to happen alongside the development of the mind in meditation. And then as we withdraw more from the world, worldly happiness, then it becomes easier to access the happiness of the mind. So that's the end of the teaching. Are there any questions? I've gone a bit longer than usual. I hope it hasn't inconvenienced you. Are there any questions? If there are no questions, we'll just end by sharing the merits. So I'm going to chant the sharing of merits, and I encourage all of you, as I say, may the merits made by me, to in your heart, get the sense that this is the merits made by each one of you, as well as me.
May the merits made by me, now or at some other time, be shared among all beings here, infinite, immeasurable, by rejoicing in this cause, this gift of merits given by me. May beings all forever live a happy life, be free from hate, and may they find the path secure, and their good wishes all succeed. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.